So, hey, Randy.
Hey, Jim.
So, did you want to get us started off with some of this stuff about what phononics is what we wanted to talk about?
Phononics is what we're going to talk about this time. And I think we're going to start off by comparing phononics with some of the other technologies that we've seen. Well, a lot of times people will talk about technology as if it's one giant edifice of applied science. But in reality, there are many technologies around us that we use all the time. And we know some of these, electronics, mechanics, acoustics, chemical engineering, nuclear technology. Phononics is a new arrival on the scene. There's some theoretical work and some basic experimentation that goes back a few decades, but it really hasn't started to gain any traction until maybe the last 10 years or so. Maybe a little bit more than that. As material science and our ability to work with manufacturing at a molecular scale has gotten better and better. So, just like electronics has different components, we've got a diode that controls the electrical current that make so that it only goes in one direction. We've got transistors, which created the entire computer revolution that allowed us to control like the flow of electricity using a gate. There's logic circuits. The researchers working in phononics are now working on emulating those same behaviors, but instead of controlling electrical currents, they want to control the flow of vibrations through matter. And that's what it all comes down to, is unlike the electron is the fundamental unit for electronics, the phonon, which is a wave packet of energy that moves through matter, is the basis of phononics.
And so how exactly is a phononic device set up? I mean, in an electronic device, what you want to do is you want to put a potential difference over something, and then the output is current.
That's right. And exactly the same thing applies with phononics, because unlike electrical energy, there aren't too many electrical potentials around us. There's a telluric current that runs through the earth. It's a very small power. There's electrical potentials that are very active during lightning storms. Well, unlike electronics, unlike those electrical potentials, phononics applies to the whole world around us. There's thermal heat flows happening all around us, between our homes and the outside world, in our car engines, and really everywhere in the world has phonon energy, because all of the matter around us has a temperature above absolute zero, and so it vibrates with phonons. It's like phonons are like the noise inside matter that we feel is heat.
So how does the phonon differ from a traditional heat wave? Like Fourier's big book was The Analytical Theory of Heat. That's where his magic came from, when he does this mathematical magic where he can replicate any function with, you know, a sum of sine wave. And he proved this with some mathematical magic, and he proved this in a book on heat. So we already knew a very, very long time ago, 200 years ago, or maybe just 150 years ago, we knew that there were these waves in matter that were heat, and these waves were basically mechanical energy. So how do these phonons differ from those waves?
Well, the phonon is just really the building block of those waves, right? The phonons are the normal modes of vibration inside matter before they all intersect and get superpositioned with each other to create a really unintelligible signal inside matter, right?
Well, I kind of understood phonons to be, how would you put this? Phonons are one of these quasi-particles. They're this thing where you have this second quantization, where you have a lot of things moving around in a harmonic way. If you look at those in the right way, you can make them look like particles. So you can do this with anything that can be represented as a Fourier series, right? You can look at it either as little excitations of energy, little particles, or as these large-scale waves in this matter. So these little displacements that are harmonic in the material, that they're like a pressure wave, they're like sound waves moving through air. In fact, they're called sound. Phonons are called sound sometimes by researchers. So they're this artifice in some way of being able to represent something by a Fourier series. You end up with something like the Schrodinger equation, which means that you can represent them as little tiny particles, little tiny wave packets, really, that move around in the material. That's what I think of when I think of a phonon, is this little tiny wave packet of sound.
Yeah, I think that it's there's a tendency, and in some of the literature that I've read, to refer to it as elastic waves, because there's a little bit of a difference between a phonon and an acoustic wave in the sense that the phonon has more degrees of freedom, right? It can be transverse in two different directions and longitudinal. And I think that acoustic waves, sound waves that we're normally used to thinking of as just through gases, that only has the longitudinal aspect, right?
I think that's going to be true if you're talking about through a gas. But you do often talk about, you would talk about pressure waves through a solid. And when you're in a solid, you have all of the issues that come with having a regular array of atoms. That means you have anisotropies in different directions, at least if you have a regular enough array.
Right. And it's interesting to see how the researchers are trying to harness those different properties, because it makes it harder to generate a technology that'll manipulate phonons. And so they're looking at things like phononic crystals, which will constrain these vibration modes to just the ones that they want within whatever application they're looking to try out.
They have to find some very special crystals, at least according to what we were reading for this.
Right, right. Your average crystal won't do it. You've actually got to make a crystal at a molecular level to be bound just the way you want, using just the materials that you want, and so that all the architecture is custom engineered. It's basically like a metamaterial.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to ask. You know, are these actually metamaterials? So, I mean, some of the things I've seen make it look that way, but they may just have been people using metamaterials to do it. The models that they use, if you look at the appendix of this paper, the models that they use don't look like things that you'd have to have a metamaterial to use. The two models that they use are, one, a model that's slightly anharmonic. So on top of having a square potential, which would be a harmonic potential, AX squared is the harmonic potential, they add on the quartic term, or BX to the fourth power term, to the potential. That's what they're calling the Frankel-Konotarova, or FK lattice, in this thing. The second one they have is something called the FPU lattice, and that's got even more people. Fermi-Pasta-Ulam.
I'm not even going to try to spell that one.
Well, those are three different short names. The middle one is something you eat for dinner.
Okay. And the first one is Fermi, like Enrico Fermi?
Yes. And that one is not really a metamaterial. That particular case seems to... Oh, I've got them backwards. The Fermi-Pasta-Ulam is the one with the quartic term. The other one is the Frankel-Konotarova lattice. And the Frankel-Konotarova lattice is the one that mathematically simulates having a substrate. So this is how you actually make a material for processing in the semiconductor industry, for example.
Right.
Is that you have a substrate of something, which is usually silicon. Then you put something else on top. But that substrate, if it's oxidized, that can be very, very smooth. But often what you'll do is you'll put a layer of just silicon. You'll take that oxide off. And there are many reasons for this. One is to try to get the atoms that you're putting on there in the exact right position. That's called epitaxy. And the other is that a lot of the things that you put on something like silicon, things you put on silica, the silicon oxide, they'll have adhesion issues because there's nothing to stick on, because that's what the oxide does, is it basically smooths everything out so you can't hook on to it. In any event, you end up having this sinusoidal potential that you put this stuff on. So either one of those is not really a metamaterial. So both of the ways that they've put these together are things that are probably actually true in a regular material that you'd actually use. So you are going to put these things on a substrate. You're not going to try to have, you know, they're talking about graphene, for example, but you're probably not going to just have a free-floating graphene circuit, because that's going to break, and then you're not going to have a device, right? On the other hand, this other one, which is the anharmonic term, most things in the real world are only approximately harmonic. If you have this huge lattice with all sorts of points all over the place, you have additional terms in that potential, and those additional terms in that potential are going to end up being, you know, these quartic terms and so forth and so on. They're still going to be restoring forces, but these additional terms are going to broaden out the potential well that keeps things in one spot.
It does seem like it's a very tricky science to pioneer, and one of the ways that I've enjoyed looking at in studying this was the way that they create like a macroscopic model, where they'll might have a series of steel cylinders, maybe a couple inches in diameter, embedded in like an elastic rubber to try to experiment with the way that these acoustic waves will pass through that material.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the idea is to try to figure out how to manufacture this kind of stuff at the nanoscale.
Well, yeah, it is very interesting that they're doing this at the nanoscale. I think it probably has to be done at the nanoscale.
Because of the wavelength of the vibrations, right?
Possibly, but apparently there's this guy named Starr who in 1936 built a junction made out of copper and an oxide phase on the other side, and he was able to get this thermal rectifier, this thermal diode, in a macroscopic system. Likely that probably doesn't do you much good, but he was able to do this basically with a wire and some he was able to create a junction that did this, and that's what they're talking about here basically, is at a junction. So when they're talking about these thermal diodes, for example, they're drawing these things out as extended things, but really the action is right at a junction between two different kinds of material.
Right. They talk about that a little bit in this colloquium paper, Phononics Manipulating Heat Flow with Electronic Analogs and Beyond, which came from the Reviews of Modern Physics in 2012. And they say towards the conclusions that that's one of the areas that they have to work on, is there isn't a good theoretical treatment, like a global theoretical treatment of what these interfaces, how these interfaces work. And so a lot of it is still very experimental. They have to try them out.
That could remain for a very long time, even with their ideas. And they seem to be doing a pretty good job. It looks like they've actually gotten thermal diode at the nanoscale, for example. And this thermal diode, all that thermal diode means, or the thermal rectifier, same idea, is that when you have something that's hot on one side and cold on the other, it will have some sort of heat flow between them, which is the same thing that happens with your wall on a cold night. But if you switch it around so it's cold on one side and hot on the other, less heat will flow the opposite direction. There will be a barrier there for some reason. And it's quite interesting that it took them a while to get this to work this way, considering that somebody had already done it at the macro scale. But it makes sense when you're thinking about this in terms of phonons. Right, because phonons end up having a spectrum in a material. If you have a really big material, you basically have phonons of all sorts. But once you start getting down to nanoscale materials, just like any other nanoscale system, you start cutting off wavelengths. You start cutting off frequencies of the different possibilities that are actually there. And so you end up with a much more discretized set of possible phonon frequencies in each part of the material. So if you have that junction, then there may be some frequencies that are shared between the two different materials. And there may be, in fact, one of the materials that shares all of its frequencies with the other material, but the other material has those extra frequencies that aren't shared. Well, a phonon of that frequency, a phonon of that wavelength, if it doesn't have a possible frequency in that other material, will just bounce off and go back into the original material at that junction. And that's even without any sort of imperfections or any of the other nastiness that happens in the real world.
And that's one of the things that they're experimenting with the phononic crystals, is band gap engineering, so that they can decide which frequencies will pass through the material. And I guess in a phononic circuit, that'll be an important thing to control.
Well, I think it's very important. Yeah, the way they have this, it's important to be able to do that just to get this thermal rectifier going, this thermal diode. After you have that thermal diode, however, it looks like they're able to put a couple of these thermal diodes together and build their transistor. And if you have the transistor, the thermal transistor, then just like in the real world,
you know, it's electronics, right?
Yeah, if you have a transistor, you can build logic, and you can build just about anything you want.
Yeah, and I've been kind of musing about this today, thinking about what it would be like to have a smartphone that was entirely running on phononics rather than electronics. And I was thinking about how, well, if you had a phone like that, you could probably just set it on the radiator to charge it up, or leave it in the sun.
Possibly. I think in general, you wouldn't have any issues with that at all. If these things were actually doing something with the transport, the problem that you'd have is getting the thermal gradient, the difference between the two edges. Because what you need are these two heat baths, a hot heat bath and a cold heat bath.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And you have to maintain those. But for the most part, you'll have plenty of phonons wandering around all the time. You just need to find a way to reliably get those gradients. And so that's really where the hard part is. And I'm not sure how you're going to be able to do that, although you might be able to use one of these energy harvesting methods. So if you're using one of these energy harvesting methods to do something with the electronics, which as long as you're going to be using an antenna, you're probably going to want to do, then what you're probably going to need to do is you're probably going to need to, what you're probably going to be able to do is to choose where you pull off those phonons, pull out that energy so that you can power up the electronic parts. And if you do that, then you'll have that thermal gradient.
Well, that's what I'm really excited about, is the opportunity to interface the two different technologies, because every technology is going to have strengths and weaknesses. And it seems like a phononic technology opens up all kinds of fascinating doors for energy harvesting. With all of the thermal currents and the heat energy around us, if there was a way to exploit that energy, then we would be able to run all our electronic devices and add new functionality to it with phononic technology.
If we could get energy harvesting working at any scale, if we could actually be integrating it into our devices, then we'd be very far along. I'm not really sure how much you can harvest with these things. I had an idea a long time ago about how to do some of these things, but everybody else thought it was BS, and so I didn't pursue it.
Damn. Don't listen to them, Jim.
Well, you have to when they're your advisor.
Damn.
The biggest question I have with all this is trying to build up a very, very large potential with energy harvesting. And I think that's something that we should save for a later episode. That's the worry for me with energy harvesting, is not just getting the energy out, is getting the energy out in a large enough amount to be able to do things with, say, consumer electronics, rather than to be able to do something like power a receiver for a MEMS circuit. It would be nice even to be able to power up something so that you could close a loop on, say, a thermal actuator in a microelectromechanical device. But, you know, it would be even better if you were able to power your computer off of ambient heat.
Well, sure. And with our electronic devices getting ever more efficient, the energy requirements are dropping, just as this technology is starting to emerge. And I've been looking at stochastic resonance energy harvesting, which is really fascinating. You know, you can take noise, really, of any kind, especially vibrational noises, and you can extract useful work, useful energy out of these bistable systems by inputting a little bit of energy so that you can multiply that energy, as long as there's a noise and that you can tune your system to resonate within the right spectrum of that noise, you can actually pull energy out, which seems to defy the second law of thermodynamics, but I think there's a nonlinearity involved that lets you sort of circumnavigate that. So we may see that in our lifetime. So that seems like something that's about to start happening, is starting to see these systems. And what if we could use that principle of stochastic resonance energy harvesting at the level, a molecular level, through some kind of phononic crystal device, some kind of solid state device? There's an awful lot of heat energy around us to tap into.
Yeah, there's quite a bit. So, I mean, it would be interesting to see how all this really works in the long run. But yeah, that's another issue. I think we ought to get back to the information processing aspects that we were talking about here, and we have actually a whole other episode planned on that already.
Yeah, there was some discussion in this colloquium paper about making the basic building blocks with the goal in mind to having a phononic computer.
Yeah, I think that's true. And one of those things that I was looking at, I think that was something somebody else was looking at. That's basically what they're talking about here, because, I mean, in this paper, they had three things that they wanted to make. They had the thermal rectifier, they had the thermal diode, then they also had the thermal transistor. And the way the thermal transistor works, instead of two heat baths, now you have three, and somehow you manipulate that third one, and that controls the energy flow around things. So now you have a control of this thermal current, so you can basically turn it on and off. It's sort of like a switch.
It was fascinating to read about that. It's such a nascent level of development that they don't seem to be anywhere near the level of mastery over these kind of systems that we have over, like, an electronic transistor, right? But they're definitely on the right track, and they definitely know how to get there.
I mean, they show you how they put the diodes together, the thermal diodes together. Really, it reminds me of sort of the level of detail you get in Feynman's lectures on computation. Rather than looking at these things in any of the other levels that I've seen, right? I've seen many, many things where they're talking about the fundamental aspects of the physics of semiconductors. I've seen many, many things where they talk about how logic works after you've already built it in a computer. There are very, very few places that I've seen, like that Feynman's lectures on computation, where they take you from the basic physics through this intermediate level that seems to be left out, which is how do you actually build a device out of that basic physics through the actual device itself. And the level of this paper is very much at that same sort of level as Feynman is, where these guys aren't telling you how to build a complicated thermal processor. They're not telling you really in too much detail about the physics, but they're saying if we have some simple physics, we have the simplified physics, we have this, you know, one-dimensional anharmonic model of a material, we modify those anharmonic potentials in slightly different ways on either side of a junction, then we can build these devices, at least theoretically. And here are some attempts that people have made to kind of sort of build some of them. And I mean, there's data here, there's enough data here to say that, you know, these are things that you probably would be able to look at. The fourth thing that they put in here was memory. They actually have a memory system that they're talking about.
Yeah, that was really intriguing, that being able to store information with a thermal circuit.
Yeah, so it's not too difficult. Basically, you have to have a place on your circuit that's insulated when you want it to be insulated. And, well, basically you end up with two of these diodes coming in and somehow balance out those things so that if you have the current basically going one way, if you have this nonlinearity going one way, you trap all the energy at one temperature and you won't lose anything. And if it's going the other way, you trap it at another temperature and it's stuck there. But if you're at some temperature in between, it moves off to one side or the other. Obviously, they generally show, we write over that temperature difference and then we write under. And the temperature difference for the high and low states is not very large. It's like 10 degrees centigrade, about 20 degrees Fahrenheit. It's really not very large what this temperature difference is that they have, but it looks quite stable.
Now, that's the part that baffled me. It was, why doesn't the memory just dissipate? Are they talking about maintaining a constant input of phonons to maintain those temperature differences, or are they saying that you would be able to leave that sitting on a table without any energy going into it and it would still hold its memory?
The way I understood it was basically that if you equilibrate the two edges, two sides, then the flow in will equal the flow out at two different temperatures. So that is sort of going to depend on how much or how many phonons get in from either side of this memory circuit. You have to have two inputs for temperature to get into the memory element and one output, all right? And if those inputs are at the same temperature, then it's going to equilibrate to one of its two stable temperatures, and which one it will depend on basically which one it's closer to in some version of closer. But to change between them, you have to have a different, on those two inputs, you have to have a different temperature difference.
So you have to force it out of its position and out of its state into a new state in order to change the memory. Nice.
It looks like there are four different diodes, basically, thermal resistors in this diagram that they've got here. Unfortunately, they put the diagram on top of a photograph, or it's an SEM image, but they superimpose it on an SEM image, which makes me not be able to understand either one.
Well, I want to offer a little clarity. SEM is scanning electron microscope, right?
Yeah. Physically, what I understood was that they've got these two things coming in here with slightly different anharmonicities. And so you end up with two of these things that they call the negative differential resistance. Did you understand what they meant by a differential resistance?
Well, isn't that, that requires an ambient heat bath, right? Because otherwise it would violate the second law of thermodynamics, as I understand it. So it's borrowing energy from its ambient environment, right?
Well, I mean, something like that's going to have to happen. But basically what it means is that at a particular temperature, increasing the temperature, or at a particular temperature difference, I should say,
reduces the resistance?
Yeah, it will reduce the resistance, but it doesn't give you a negative resistance. That's the important thing. That's the reason why it's okay. So you reduce the resistance at a particular temperature difference. First, as you increase the temperature difference, you increase the current. But there's a point where by increasing the temperature difference, you decrease the current. And that point is where you have that negative differential resistance. And this is something that you can get in semiconductors as well. Something you can get in semiconductor physics for electrons, right? For regular electrical current, you can do things like this as well. And they're very important.
Yeah, they were saying that this is the fundamental principle upon which the thermal diode and everything else is built upon.
Yeah, and you need to be able to do this. Otherwise, you end up having more and more heat current going through there. So the heat current just being time rate of change of the heat divided by the area of the thingy-mabobber. I'll cut that out, because nobody wants to hear that sort of talk.
I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting. Gives you something to think about.
So anyways, that negative differential resistance is very, very important for this entire idea. In the memory chip, they had to have two things with different negative thermal resistances coming into the memory element. That's sort of the way I understood this while reading this paper, is that you need to get those things, and I assume that you then just have some sort of output that will always be outputting something. Because you're always going to have something coming in, which means you're going to always have something going out.
Right, so it maintains a constant temperature. So it's what's intriguing is to see how the geometry plays such a key role in the design and effectiveness of these components. Like, they've showed different scanning electron microscope photographs of nanotubes that had one side were wider or reinforced with a heavier atom. They had graphene wrapped into a cone shape or just cut into trapezoidal geometries or carbon nanocones or graphene nanoribbons, one that was wrapped like a Mobius strip. And it was just the pure geometry and the chemical properties of the binding properties of these materials that created these effects for controlling the vibrations. It's a very visual and, you can visually conceptualize what they're doing by looking at the materials themselves. Unlike electronics, where, the components themselves don't tell you anything. Here's this nascent science where you can actually, see the structures and get an intuitive sense for how the structures are playing a role in the transfer of those vibrations.
This was also very strange because this is another place where we see that Berry phase. Again, people are very, very, very loose with this Berry phase idea.
Can you tell me about that Berry phase idea that you're talking about?
The Berry phase is a phase accumulation in the wave packet due to whatever quantum mechanical instances you have. That's why it shows up in like topological insulators and things like that. It ends up being important for the quantum Hall effect and stuff like that. But, when people just talk about this Berry phase, since it's always in a material as far as I can tell, mm-hmm. It's always geometrical in nature, the first thing I'm thinking about when you say Berry phase is a phase of matter. But it's not a phase of matter. It's just an accumulation of phase because of the, quantum mechanical stuff going on. Because of the geometry. The geometry is causing your wave function as it traverses around something to accumulate a phase difference in whatever it is that it's accumulating that phase difference in. Here I don't really know where that phase is accumulating. I guess it's in the total heat current. In quantum mechanics, the thing that's accumulating that is the vector potential. I guess that's a different sort of idea going into it, but still it's the same idea, is that if you go around once this little Mobius strip thing, right? Mm-hmm. This little Mobius graphene strip, you go around that once, then you accumulate 2π's worth of phase that shouldn't probably be detectable most of the time, but does lead to real effects. Like, again, it turns into this phononic Hall effect. Because of this Berry phase, I guess, I think because of this Berry phase, I'm not completely sure because it's a couple of paragraphs, you end up with this effect where these phonons, which are non-charged particles, which are not fermions like an electron, these second quantized particles obey a completely different kind of statistics. They obey Bose statistics. So there's no reason why they should do anything at all like an electron. They're not charged. They obey different physical laws, except when you put a magnetic field on them, they turn. There's no reason why a phonon should turn in a magnetic field in my brain, right?
Right, yeah. It's hard to understand.
That's something I'd like to see if we can find something interesting in that and just talk about that at some point in the future. But still, that's something that's happening because of the geometry in these things, and it's something that seems to be important in actually designing some of these things. like they're doing this on some sort of organic molecule in one of these examples. But the geometrical phase that they're talking about looks exactly like some sort of benzene ring or something like that.
Yeah, I'm kind of baffled. I don't really understand. There's a diagram in this paper that shows a plane with a hot side and a cold side. And that's what? A magnetic field in the y-axis. And the heat flow has a preferential direction that bends it from in a 90-degree angle from the hot to the cold.
That's this Hall effect thing.
Yeah, it's baffling. Like, why that direction? That doesn't. How can it have a preferred direction if it doesn't have a magnetic field or is electrical field?
so it doesn't have any rationale, as far as I can see, for a coupling to a magnetic field. Because a phonon does not have an electrical charge. So it's not providing an electric current or anything like that. It's just heat moving through the material. But you can bend the heat. Now, that's another thing that might be really, really interesting. You might be able to do wonders for people's bills by building paint out of this stuff.
Yeah, making the heat circulate around the room instead of going out through the wall.
That's right. But yeah, I don't have any idea why this would actually be. I mean, this is something that apparently somebody predicted a long time ago. Well, maybe not a long time ago, but many years before it actually came about. So it was in a paramagnetic dielectric. Right. And the important thing about that is that a paramagnet, each atom inside of the, maybe this is how it actually works, right? So each atom inside of a paramagnet is magnetized. Each atom in a paramagnet has a magnetic moment, whereas there are other materials called diamagnets, which do not carry a magnetic moment unless it's induced by a magnetic field. And those work in exactly the opposite way. So basically a paramagnet will be attracted to a very strong magnetic field, and a diamagnet will be repelled by it. But it has to be a lot stronger than your refrigerator magnet. You know, in Florida, they have these giant spinning electromagnets. That's how you get a field strong enough to really see an effect on one of these things and, you know, levitate your frogs.
Well, it looks, I'm looking at this section right now about this effect, and it seems like they're still trying to work it out, that there's several competing explanations, and one of them is that this effect derives from the magnetic vector potential in ionic crystal lattices, where the vibration of atoms with an effective charge will experience a Lorentz force. And there's another one here. It says that it results from a Raman spin-orbit interaction. I guess there's a spin-phonon coupling that they're still working on to figure out.
So I was wrong about that. The dielectric part is also important, right? So a dielectric is basically an insulator. That's important because otherwise the electrons would carry the heat away.
Mm.
You couldn't tell if the electrons are carrying the heat away, then they could be the things that are bending in the field when they're moving around.
Right.
So yeah, they had a couple of these different things here to talk about them. In some place, they were talking about a ballistic heat effect. Do you understand what ballistic means in this case?
I thought that it just meant sort of like a photon traveling through space, is that it traveled as a unit, as a packet of energy along a given vector. Is that right?
So ballistic transport basically means that what happens to your phonon in this material for a particular kind of phonon is that when it travels, it hits a spot where the phonon frequency or the phonon wavelength exactly matches the lattice wavelength of your material, so that now it just takes off in a straight line and doesn't scatter off anything. So that's ballistic transport, unlike what usually happens with an electron or a phonon, which is it scatters off of everything, and so you get sort of a net push in some direction.
Right, but it's dispersive. I'm intrigued by this because it made me wonder. I wonder what kind of energy storage capabilities might arise from phononics. You know, we really struggle with electronics. I mean, you've got batteries, which are, you know, the chemical energy, the real limited amount of energy you can store there. There's capacitors that you can temporarily store energy in, and maybe more long term. But there's still real limits to the energy density. But I wonder if phononics will give us another way to store energy. You know, I wonder if there's a way to design maybe like a toroidal phononic crystal where the heat energy could just circulate indefinitely without dissipating.
There might be a way to do something like that, but I think you'd end up with some issues. I think probably the closest thing you're going to see to that is this sort of memory that they're talking about. If they can build this memory, they're already building something very much like that.
Because it's storing energy in the form of its memory?
So that memory is staying at one particular temperature, and it's stuck there. You're never going to be able to get something that, say, you put something in and it drops away, right? Or you put something in and it stays there no matter how much stuff you put in there. Right, because soon you'd end up with something that's 700 Kelvin or 8,000 Kelvin or 10,000 Kelvin. I mean, it just, things would find a way in, but they wouldn't find a way out, right? So you'd have to at some point have some sort of dissipation thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what's going on in this memory thing, mm-hmm. right? This memory element that they've got some way to take that extra temperature and let it dissipate, and then stay at whatever temperature that was. So they have something similar to that. Now, it may not be optimized for what you want it to do. It may be at too low a temperature, but if it's just at too low a temperature, then it's just a materials issue. It's an engineering problem, right? But it is a...
It sounds like you're talking about basically the phononic equivalent of a capacitor, because you've got a higher potential on one side than the other.
It's not that different. I think what you're really talking about is something like the phononic equivalent of flash memory. So but it's close enough. Because, I mean, that's all flash memory really is a sticky capacitor.
I don't really know how flash memory works. I've never studied it. And you're the one who worked at the magnetic storage company, right?
Yeah, and if you listen to my description, you still don't understand it. Flash memory is not magnetic.
Oh, it's not. See, that's the thing. I don't know what flash memory is. That's why I wanted to ask you, and I thought it was magnetic.
Yeah, it's completely electrical in nature. They basically just store a little bit of charge on something and take its ability away to disappear before they take off the potential. Oh, that is such a bad description. But
well, I'm only looking for a rudimentary understanding, so that'll do.
All right. Oh, okay. But anyway.
You're kicking yourself.
Yeah, so that's pretty much what I've got on whatever it was we were talking about. What were we talking about?
Well, we were talking about the memory, and you were talking about how it stores the memory.
Okay. Oh, you were talking about storing this stuff. Yeah. So, that's all I've really got on using something like this to store energy for a very, very long period of time. If the memory works, then you'll be able to store energy in some way. Now, I'm not sure how much. I'm not sure how useful it will be compared to other technologies. And that's something I think we have to think about when we're talking about technologies and something like the phononics as a technology, is that not only does it have to work, not only does it have to do these cool things like, you know, couple to photons, couple to light.
Because I could imagine you could have some kind of a display with the phononics, right? Because it couples to photons and there's optomechanical crystals and things. So couldn't you make some kind of visual display, like a monitor, using phononics?
You might be, but just like any other technology that you'd want to use with it, it would have to be 10 times as good or 10 times cheaper than whatever it is we have. I mean, but...
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying to compete.
If this stuff works, then that might be viable. Let me think. I think the interesting thing here was that the wavelength of the phonons
are like optical wavelengths.
Well, the wavelengths of the photons at optical frequencies are nanoscale in size. The nanoscale size of the
phononic wavelength in the material?
The nanoscale size of the photon, because the photon's got a wavelength of something around 400 to 700 nanometers, on the order of the wavelength of most heat. Mm-hmm. But that actually has a very large wavelength.
Through air, but I think in solids, where we're talking about phononics, it's a different thing, right?
Question is it where it couples, right? Mm. So it should be coupling by wavelength, I think. I don't think it, or it should be coupling by frequency, not by wavelength, right? The frequency is what's making things jump up and down, right? The frequency of the change of the electric field is going to cause some sort of change in the molecular vibrations, right? It's not the wavelength of the thing that's going to do that. I think. I'm going to have to cut this out because I don't remember exactly how it worked.
Well, I'm trying to think. I think that an optical light frequency moving through a vacuum has a similar wavelength to the phononic vibrations in a solid, because the speed of vibrations through a solid is so much slower.
That's something like that, yeah.
It's like only 1,000 meters per second.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. 300 meters per second.
So I think the wavelength is similar, right?
Yeah, I just don't remember.
Fair enough.
I was listening to the guy talk, and I thought, yeah, that's important to remember. That's important to remember. And of course, I got it all mixed up in my head, and I can't remember which way it went.
But isn't that how optomechanical crystals work? Is that light shines on them, and because and they can couple to the crystals because the crystal will oscillate.
I would think that it would have to be a frequency that's in the frequency spectrum of the material.
Right.
Which would mean that it's the frequency that's important, not the wavelength. The frequency is the energy, not the wavelength. So if you were switching between different... Yeah, so I think if you were coupling at the wavelength level, which would mean your wavelengths were the same, you'd be switching frequencies, and if you were switching frequencies, then you'd be switching energies of the quantized oscillations. So that would mean at best you would be able to do it one way but not the other way. You'd be able to get photon input to the phononic device but not output.
But the energy is also going to be affected because you're talking about moving materials with a mass, right? So if it dropped the frequency... but it was moving more matter, wouldn't the energy still be the same?
I think that's already taken care of in the phonon spectrum, right? Your phonon spectrum already assumes that your atoms have mass. So the phonon spectrum will have that frequency based on the mass of the material, in part. It's going to be much more detailed than that because it's a spectrum with peaks and valleys and things based on lattice constants and stuff like that. But it is going to be based on the material properties of the lattice. Frequency to frequency match should be the thing that does the coupling. The wavelengths should be the thing that you get for free. But that means that you're going to end up with probably a much smaller wavelength of a phonon. That doesn't make much sense. Because the heat wavelengths, the IR wavelengths, are very, very large, right? The infrared wavelength is very, very large, which is where you'd expect most of this... Actually, that's exactly the frequencies that you would not want to operate something like this at.
Right, because it would just create more noise for the system. It would overheat itself, right?
There was something about that where it seemed to me like there had to be at least three regimes, right? Where you have a long wavelength regime, a short wavelength regime, and a sort of intermediate wavelength regime. So, you know, if you have that long wavelength regime, there's not really much you can do with phononics.
I came across, they mentioned at one point, phonon polaritons. And they were talking, and they described that as the interaction of optical phonons with infrared photons. I'm not really sure what an optical phonon is, I guess.
Oh, it would be a phonon with an optical frequency.
But I mean, would that mean that you'd be able to see it as light, or?
No, you can't. You can't see it as light.
It would have a frequency of light. That seems like a really high frequency. So, but they're saying that since that's an interaction, they must have a similar energy level, right? The infrared photon must be equivalent to an optical phonon?
Yeah, the optic...
So you're right. The phonons would have a higher frequency when they interact with light. Let's talk about the technological implications for phononics. I think right now there's a company called Phononics somewhere in the States that's manufacturing some kind of special thermoelectric solid-state cooling systems for hospitals and labs and things like that. I guess you can get a really high precision control of your refrigeration system that way. But there's also some other prospects in the future which I think are really interesting. They mentioned the Brownian motor at one point. That's interesting. Isn't that the like a molecular scale motor that gets ratcheted forward? I think Feynman might have talked about this, by the random vibrations of the material around it?
Yeah, a Brownian ratchet. So basically, it's something that can move one way or another. I think that's another thing that we'll be talking about. It's really the sort of thing where it's really the way that the energy harvesting works. So, I mean, the thermal ratchet is something that we'd really be talking about with the energy harvesting, I think. That's basically all that is that you have some anisotropy in the material so that, you know, you can move one way but not the other way. And that's why the thermal ratchet or Brownian ratchet or something like that is the way they talk about it, is that's the way you get energy out of these things, right?
That ratchet system is the asymmetry that you introduce to the system so that you can get it to do work for you?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool. They also talked about a couple fascinating ideas. I guess this also kind of bridges into the realm of metamaterials, but they mentioned heat cloaks. Like, I guess that's like an invisibility cloak, but in the infrared spectrum, and focused heat rays, so that you could couple, I guess, to the atmosphere and send a laser beam of almost of heat energy at something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of creepy. It's almost like a Tesla death ray. Can you imagine just cooking somebody from, you know, a distance? They talked about thermally insulated buildings with a really high efficient insulators, because phononics is the mastery of that heat energy, right? So the amount of energy efficiency that you could get would be incredible. There's, of course, the transforming of waste heat from industry, and I guess even like your car engine and things like that, directly into electricity. And it's one of the papers mentioned earthquake protection, but I think that, again, that crosses over into the metamaterials, because vibrations of that frequency, of like earthquake frequency, you're going to need a larger scale system, right?
Well, yeah, so would not get into metamaterials, because metamaterials are generally very small things.
Okay.
So metamaterials are generally, you know, tailored geometrical objects at the nanoscale in generally, you know, large arrays. Probably not necessarily, but generally large arrays of objects. So you'd make, say, lots of little nickel C's or something like that, and you'd embed them in copper, and that would give you some special way of doing something or other.
So earthquake for a building would be just a big phononic component that would basically be band gap engineered so that the vibrations from an earthquake wouldn't be able to shake the building apart. Is that right?
I guess so. I mean, I didn't read the applications very much, because usually the applications are just anything they can make up to make it sound like it's applied.
Right, it's a little early within this technology to have any idea about where it's going to head, but I guess they're trying to figure out, well, these are plausible directions to go in. I guess you don't really know until you get there. One of the other things that they mentioned that was interesting was the way that they're experimenting with manufacturing. And MIT was talking about using interference lithography through photosensitive fluids. I thought that was fascinating. You get different laser beams intersecting in a plane. And then I guess that activates the photosensitive fluids so that you can very precisely control positioning and thickness of the material that condenses out of that fluid.
Yeah, sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, I guess they've been pioneering that up there. They get to do all the fun stuff at MIT.
Well, they think up all the fun stuff at MIT.
So did you see anything else interesting in this when you went over phononics?
I think we probably hit everything that we really need to hit, especially if we're going to visit this at least twice more.
Well, thank you so much for going over this with me tonight, Jim. Phonox seems like a really interesting new technology.
Yeah, it was great. Talk to you again.
You don't want to be sued for mentioning them? That's free press.